To tell you what happens next in the Anna Clark story, I'm gonna need to take you back. Like, way back. The date is March 3rd and the year 1809. With the second of his terms as President of the United States of America drawing to a close, lawyer, architect, and statesman, Thomas Jefferson is preparing to transition power to his successor and return home to Virginia. After decades in public service, including as congressman, governor, diplomat, and president, Jefferson has no plans to sit idle upon the resumption of his private life. To the contrary, the soon-to-be former president has laid the groundwork for two new projects, both long dear to his heart. One is the creation of a new public university, a University of Virginia, that he will design and establish near his family's home in Charlottesville. That university, a grand institution of international renown, still thrives today and serves as a large part of Jefferson's legacy. The other was more personal, but no less ambitious. And believe it or not, it began with Jefferson taking a razor to his own Bible. Have you ever heard of the Jefferson Bible? The project, which to be clear, Jefferson himself never called a Bible, was a painstaking effort for the Founding Father. He started with two copies of the King James Bible and spent years carefully using razor blades to extract certain passages from the existing tomes and reassemble them by reordering and gluing them onto blank pages. He was crafting a new work of sorts, a truncated and condensed version of the New Testament. It was actually Jefferson's second attempt at creating a derivative work focused exclusively on the practical and moral teachings of his faith. Though the work, commonly known today as the Jefferson Bible, was arguably now more philosophical than religious in nature, Jefferson was well aware of the controversy it might stoke, completing his project in relative secrecy. He never published his work, preferring to reflect on its passages privately in the evening, and he only shared the fruits of his endeavor with friends. For Jefferson, the effort was never a provocative one. An academic and philosopher, lawyer and pragmatic statesman, Jefferson hoped that by stripping a complicated and extensive text, even one as iconic and authoritative as the Bible, to its most essential and verifiable elements, would help him to better understand that work's inherent utility and credibility, and in turn, deepen his own connection and relationship with it. But not even Jefferson himself could have guessed how, two centuries later, in an office not far from where he once sat, gluing excised passages to blank pages years before, that this eccentric endeavor of our third president would be the very thing that led Tommy and me to the biggest breakthrough in Anna's case. This is Intersections, a special limited presentation of The Brink with Benjamin Bryant and the BZMP. Exploring the aftermath of the night of shock tragedy took away one woman's ability to tell her own story and gave others the opening to revise and rewrite a very different one for her. I'm Benjamin Bryant.
How about here?
Actually, can you put it a little closer? Just so I can reference it more easily.
Uh-huh.
What?
If somebody came in here right now, they'd totally think we were serial killers in a Lifetime movie.
Okay, so that was funny. Mostly because it was true. A stranger, particularly one who knew their way around a good movie of the week, would definitely be forgiven for mistaking our investigative journalism in action for a different kind of obsession altogether. Between all of the marked-up photos, maps, printouts, post-it notes, and the red yarn on pushpins we'd used to document progression and connection between all the things we found, the binders of annotated documents, and the recycling bin full of energy drink cans, the scene probably did look a little intense. But it was also the product of an incredibly fruitful process. At this point, our research was yielding new information at every turn. We'd been through thousands of pages of documents, conducted hours of interviews, and spent days analyzing photos, maps, medical and service records, and researching everything from legal minutiae to the specific specs of Anna's motorcycle. Our review of Staff Sergeant Anastasia Clark's line of duty investigation included the final report, all the exhibits cited by the investigator, the summary memo he'd written instead of providing witness statements, and the records he said he reviewed. It helped to clarify and organize key facts in the case. And our own research, even when limited to public records and materials available to the investigator, was yielding new information at every turn. It was a lot, though. Our own inadvertent orgy of evidence. And our job to cut through and find the truth, with Anna's family having lost all of her appeals to date, and every request to redo or at least reopen the investigation denied, the clock was ticking for Anna Clark. You know, that's the rub when it comes to real-time investigative journalism. Even when you know your job is to simply uncover the facts and report them honestly, hopefully inspiring change when done, you're still human. And when the facts you uncover reveal time-sensitive problems that no one but you seems interested in investigating, you do feel it. When a difference of even 1 week in what you can uncover, verify, and take to air could be the difference between your reporting helping the very people you're covering, or simply serving as a cautionary case study in the future, you can't help but be aware of that clock. And you can't help but hear it ticking away. We had a mountain of information, and three questions to answer as quickly and accurately as possible before time ran out. One, was Anna Clark truly not in the line of duty due to her own misconduct? Two, was the investigation that officially concluded she was not sufficient to justify the decision made, with all that decision would take from her and her family? And three, if it was not sufficient, how in the hell did that happen anyway?
Gets crazier. That biker, she clears that small bridge in no time, takes that bike to speeds above triple digits, loses Officer Cummings, but is watched by cop after cop after cop as she shoots by at insane speeds and handles not one, but two 90-degree or tighter turns without slowing down even once.
Remember that version of events? Filled with so many action-packed details, triple-digit speed, stunt driver-quality handling, and a final impact at 70 miles per hour. You half expected Jason Statham or Dwayne The Rock Johnson to show up at some point. That retelling was so compelling, it just felt convincing. And it certainly had been for everyone who had touched the Anna Clark case so far, including reviewers, approvers, and later appellate authorities. Repeatedly, those who read Vosburgh's account declared it enough to answer the central question. Had Staff Sergeant Clark committed misconduct? Had she acted in a willful and intentionally reckless manner? Even as some acknowledged the possibility of errors and inconsistencies in Vosburgh's investigation, they declared, often quoting from his account of the incident, that the very details of Anna's behavior were enough to support the finding of misconduct. The challenge was clear. And supported by the regulation's guidance. Alternate possibilities and issues with the investigation, no matter how credible, were no longer enough to reverse Anna's fate. The Army would need new evidence or mitigating information as or more compelling than what Vosburgh had turned in. And it would have to overwhelmingly suggest a completely different conclusion, or they would neither be required nor inclined to give the case another look. Looking around that office, papers, printouts, red strings and all, our work to date, past investigative experience, and journalistic instincts told us we already had the answer. We just had to find it. But with limited time before Anna's final appeal, we'd need to move quickly to complete our recreated LOD investigation. We'd have to determine and fully support whatever fact-based alternate possibilities emerged, and we had to simultaneously understand what Vosburgh himself did and did not do, to end up with such certainty on his end.
It all starts with breaking down the LOD investigation process. The first step is evidence gathering. Thankfully, this step is fairly straightforward, thanks to clear guidance, effectively a checklist, in the regulations as to exactly what type of evidence the IO and we had to collect and review. For some incidents, including those involving self-harm or vehicular accidents, like Anna's, the collection and consideration of specific additional evidence is also directed. Second is assessment. This is where the investigator reviews the various pieces of evidence he or she has gathered, weighing the relative credibility and import of each to make as many findings of fact as possible. From these, the IO can create a credible timeline of events, make relevant associations and connections between findings, and draw out potential reasons and explanations for the incident, figuring out whether any of them suggest a possibility of misconduct or willful negligence. Finally, in the third step, the IO gets down to business. In this step, he or she reassesses only the evidence in support of credible explanations. For those suggesting possible misconduct, he or she must invite the subject of the investigation to provide additional explanation or mitigating information in response to his findings, allowing for the IO to make a fully informed determination. And the regs make that part easy as well. Once the evidence can be compared side by side, with all mitigating factors and special considerations taken into account, a simple instruction applies. If the weight of the evidence in support of misconduct exceeds half of the total evidence for all credible possibilities, what's known as a preponderance of the evidence, the Army requires a finding of not in the line of duty due to own misconduct. But if the likelihood of misconduct, no matter how sensational or substantial, does not exceed 50% of the total weighted evidence for all possibilities, the regulation requires the soldier remain in the line of duty, retaining benefit eligibility and more. It's that simple.
Yeah, simple. What wasn't that simple? Taking all of the evidence we'd collected in step one, and collecting steps two and three, while using Vosburgh's report as a baseline to compare, contrast, and understand his investigative process, his findings, and his conclusions so that we could show definitively what was wrong with them and why what we had discovered would produce a different outcome. That was the Army standard, and it was Anna's best chance for justice. And the way to do it came straight from the 1800s, and our nation's third president, Thomas Jefferson. No, we aren't going back to the 1800s again, but Tommy and I did find ourselves thinking of Thomas Jefferson and his ambitious project as we contemplated distilling the information we'd collected and uncovered in the Anna Clark case to its most credible, relevant, and useful form. When Jefferson first set out to create a customized version of the New Testament for his personal study and reflection, one can only imagine how daunting and time-consuming the task of individually evaluating more than 1,800 verses, located over 260 chapters and hundreds of pages, must have seemed. And with only two printed copies of the King James Bible and a razor blade in hand to make permanent cuts, there was every incentive to make the right call the first time, every time. No pressure at all, Mr. President. Scholars like M. Andrew Holochak suggest that Jefferson met these challenges by executing a careful system of evaluation. He would examine each passage objectively using defined inclusion and exclusion standards. That would allow him to quickly determine the relevance of any given verse, story, or passage to his specific intent, while at the same time validating that decision's objectivity using his pre-established criteria. Basically, Jefferson, knowing what he was looking for, what he wanted to isolate for his own personal study and reflection out of the New Testament, decided in advance what kinds of things would get a passage kept in or thrown out. And then he just started at the beginning, able to cut the work down, literally with a razor blade, as he went along, until he was left only with what he wanted, the simplest, most credible, and most useful passages for his own personal study Bible. It made sense to us how we could apply that same thinking to our challenges, how we could take a veritable orgy of evidence and distill it down to its most authoritative, credible, and useful parts using objective inclusion and exclusion criteria. Yeah, a system like that was exactly what we were looking for.
So what do we need to do?
Well, where this leaves us is we have to select our own criteria. So we have our own selection criteria, that's the stuff we keep. And then we have our own deselection criteria, which is the stuff that gets cut out. So if we follow that model, it seems like the selection criteria is pretty straightforward. Anything that the reg says he's supposed to have in there, anything the appointing memo requires, if he's got it, that stays. As long as it's not invalidated somehow by the deselection criteria. And then there are going to be other relevant facts that he found, and they might not be required, but if they're relevant, they should stay in there.
As long as they don't violate any of the deselection criteria.
Exactly. And it's the deselection criteria we have to be really careful about. Whatever we pick, it's got to be objective. It's got to be simple. It's got to be easy to understand. I think the most important thing is that when people look at it,
They know exactly what we were doing, and there's not even a hint that we were taking things out just because it fit one narrative or another. I really want to be fair, and I really want to start from the purest possible place.
Okay, that makes sense.
I'm just not sure how to go about it.
What about Brian's razor?
You remember that?
I think we all do. It worked well back then.
You know, that might work here.
Ben laughs, but the truth is, Brian's razor would work. If we were going to follow Jefferson's lead and cut all of the information in front of us down to the verifiable parts most relevant to what we needed, we, like Jefferson, were going to need a razor of our own. And it turns out, we already had the one we needed. You've heard Ben and me mention some of our past work for the President and the Department of Defense. We've worked several short-term efforts, commissioned to investigate, analyze, and report out fact-based findings to the President and Congress on high-profile issues. In 2009, we joined a small 45-day task force called for by President Obama to look into the Fort Hood shooting. A year later, we assisted the Don't Ask, Don't Tell Working Group in compiling, editing, and presenting more than a year of research, surveys, and analysis to President Obama and Congress. These and other projects often involve sorting through a mountain of source material, including redundant, conflicting, and irrelevant information. This would frustrate me and other members of Ben's team, until he proposed a solution, a process, to help us sift through all the existing material quickly and efficiently, and isolate only the relevant and useful information from everything coming in. This process was simple, almost philosophical. Isolate core facts. First, by disregarding anything verifiably false. Then, set aside anything not supported by the evidence. Finally, flag anything seemingly unrelated or irrelevant, as its presence could be prejudicial. Your core facts are what's left over. For example, applying that heuristic, or shortcut really, helped us to isolate the common truths from a varied, even conflicting set of witness or expert perspectives, and quickly became part of our standard process. Along the way, someone started calling up Brian's razor, and the name stuck. Now seemed like the perfect time to pull that old tool out of the box.
With our process in place, we tackled Vosburgh's report and the memorandum first. Not only could they give us a baseline for contrast and comparison in terms of our work, applying the process would help us see which of the required steps Vosburgh did and did not complete to specification, and would lay out which gaps still needed filling in. In addition, the report and memo served, ironically, as the primary accounts of the police interaction and accident itself. You might recall that Vosburgh described regular contact and interviews with the Watertown police, a review of assorted police and accident records that couldn't be released to him, and indicated consideration of various aspects of the accident. Instead of providing evidence, however, statements from the police, photos, maps, and copies of all of the things he had been provided, Vosburgh decided to curate and summarize all of it into his own 2-page characterization of the encounter and accident, and then cited his own memorandum as his primary source for his final report and determination regarding her intentions and behavior. It was that summary and subsequent report that was reviewed and approved by his supervisors and has been cited over and over again by those turning down Anna's appeals and refusing her family's request for a new investigation. So those two documents were at the core of everything. So boiling them down to their core truths first just made sense. The difference was striking. Turns out, when you take this, and remove any assertions that are verifiably untrue, unsupported by actual evidence, or irrelevant to the questions that are actually under investigation, you end up with something more like this. While not nearly as exciting, this version was exactly where we needed to be. Not because it did all that much for Anna. Questions as to why she didn't stop for the police, why she carelessly shot between two cars on a city bridge, why she was going above the speed limit after she'd been cautioned by her doctor to limit driving. All those still persisted. Those details and others Vosburgh mentioned, such as a recently suspended license due to failure to pay traffic tickets, or allowing her registration and insurance to lapse, they weren't a good look. That was actually the funny thing. The core facts on their own were bad enough to at least suggest misconduct without all of the apparent embellishments. An average speed of 50 on a route with a speed limit of 35? Driving on a suspended license? Seems bad enough. It doesn't have to be a police chase at triple digits for nearly the whole route to be problematic. I mean, the possibility for misconduct and willful negligence, it's already there. And it actually appears that the suggestion of misconduct is where Vosburgh just stopped investigating. His report presents this possibility, and that's it. The only evidence he offers, such as it is that which directly supports that possibility and anything else, including things the regulation specifically requires he address, just isn't included. Now, don't get me wrong. It's only human nature to become less curious about a thing once you feel like, well, we all know what happened here. But this is why the regulations for LOD investigations exist in the first place. They're the product of collected best practices and lessons learned over years of similar investigations. And what the Army, and the hundreds if not thousands of investigating officers who'd come before Vosburgh knew, is that not everything is always as it seems. That the first draft of a story is rarely the most complete or accurate one. And that's precisely why the regulation sets forth a series of additional requirements, investigative steps, and special issues to consider once an investigator suspects misconduct. Vosburgh doesn't mention any of this. In fact, there's no record at all that he ever continued on to complete this part of the investigation. So we did. And when we come back, our unexpected discovery finally reveals the truth behind almost everything. But fair warning, it might make you really, really mad.